The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they are easy, but
because they are hard. Start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Sunday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in today. And we're going to be checking in on Mars in just a few minutes. But first, a couple of announcements. If you would like to call and talk to our guest, Chris Carberry, the phone number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screener, so just be patient. We'll answer and get you up on air as quickly as possible. If you would like to call and talk to Chris, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223, which I just said, and I'm going to repeat that a lot during the show since we are driving for more phone calls from all of you. Email, of course, if you insist on using it, is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you can also send us a comment or question on the blog for this show, which is on thespaceshow.com website. Far right menu, upcoming shows. This is the first show listed. So open up that archive page and the comment section is at the bottom and we will get your message right away if you choose to post it that way. Also, we will post our website newsletter on the website shortly after this program airs today, and that will have all the details for next week, plus the updated list of coming shows through the second quarter of 2017. And remember, you can listen to our programs right off of our website or very rapidly download the program. Check out our store. It's in the support menu, upper left-hand corner, for coffee mugs and T-shirts and logo wear. The most important button to me is to support the Space Show over on the right side. And remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit, and we are able to bring you these programs because of your support. And we thank all of you who do support us. And remember, if you're a federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true for those of you who are in California and pay California taxes. If you have any questions, just don't hesitate to email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. We are trademarked and copyrighted, but we do encourage all of you to share our programming with people. You can download the shows very quickly, as I said earlier, and you can send them the shows or just give them the URLs, but do let people know about them, promote them, and send them around, and I think your friends will thank you very much for doing that. We do have sponsors, and please pay attention to the sponsor ads that go across our homepage. At least look at them from time to time. They have good information in them. And for the first segment of today's program, there are two sponsors, and the Integrated Space Plan is one of them. As you know, this is a detailed 100-year forecast of the future in space, and it includes Earth to orbit, reusable in-space transportation. It also depicts development of the Moon and Mars, followed by the base in the asteroid belt and space settlements. And their website, where all of it comes together, is thespaceplan.com. And if you view it online, you can click on any of the 500 elements for a lot more information. You can order the Integrated Space Plan poster, which is very big, and you can hang it on your wall. It's full color. And you can see it on their website, and they say it's guaranteed to get you more excited about our future in space, and I do have a copy of it, and it is exciting to take a look at. So again, thespaceplan.com, they are updating it. The new updates are going to be rolled out at the ISDC conference by the National Space Society later in May. And then also for this segment of the program, the Space Foundation is sponsoring us, and they have their 33rd Space Symposium coming up. It's just around the corner, April 3rd through the 6th in Colorado Springs. And they say connect, engage, and get business done all in one place at their 33rd Space Symposium. So do check it out, and hopefully you'll be there. And if you are, let me know so we can find a way to meet up and visit. And Chris Carberry, as I said, is with us today, and he is the CEO of Explore Mars Incorporated, and this was an organization created to promote science and technology innovation and education with a use for Mars exploration. He's been active in space advocacy community and Mars for a number of years because he was the executive director of the Mars Society before taking on it and being a co-founder of Explore Mars. You can read his full bio on the website, so I'm not going to read about him anymore. We're going to talk to him. But their Humans to Mars event, which is really quite something, and probably one of the best, if not the best event for a space advocacy organization, especially for Mars, probably is the best event. It's coming up May 8th through 12th. And Chris, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me on again, David. It's actually May 9th through 11th, not 8th through 12th.
Okay. Well, I saw on the website you've got something for May 8th. And it looked like it went through May 12th. So.
Okay, that's fair enough. We are, the formal conference is 9th through 11th, but we have some preliminary events on the 8th, and then, of course, we're on Capitol Hill on the 12th. So fair enough, you actually corrected me.
Tell us about what's in store this year, and do you think we're getting closer?
I think we are. As we all know, there's an awful lot of policy hypothesizing going on right now. It's a lot of speculation about what the direction of the U.S. space program will be over the next few years. But with the Humans to Mars Summit, I think it's perfectly timed. And so we'll be talking about a lot of these issues, obviously policy, and we'll see. In 2 months, we'll see where actually, you know, if there's a little more focus, if more decisions have been made on which direction we're actually going. But some of the topics we're going to be addressing are, you know, things that are relevant for all of these, all destinations, you know, the impact on small business. So we're having a special session on that to look at the big impact on space exploration within small businesses. It's amazing the number of businesses, small ones around the country, that you wouldn't think were working on the space program that actually are, providing great jobs. We're also going to look at risk. You know, if now that we're actually looking like we are going to start exploring again, we are going to have to relook at our risk tolerance. And so we're going to have a good discussion on that, what level we're willing to take and what sort of adjustments in our current risk tolerance we'll have to make. If we're going to go to Mars or anywhere else, if we're going to the surface of the moon or, you know, any of these destinations we're talking about. So this is, you know, another one of these key topics, as well as, you know, like we did last year, trying to engage the entertainment industry, looking at, you know, how the impact on entertainment and how science and science fiction interact. So there are a lot of topics. I think it's really coming together well. We're going to be making a lot of updates of the agenda over the next week. So we should be in pretty good shape, you know, when we reach a two-month out period, which will be sometime next week, or this week, actually.
Do you have a crystal ball into the let's go to Mars with people thoughts of the new administration?
You know, it's hard to say. every other moment. And we spoke to the transition team. I've spoken to, and our team has spoken to, a lot of the advisors. And I'm actually fairly positive. You know, there is a lot of interest in finding ways of stimulating commercial efforts, from what I've heard, for, you know, lunar exploration and, you know, utilization of resources. But there's certainly a lot of interest in continuing to move forward towards that goal of getting to Mars by the early 2030s. And on top of that, you may have heard that there's the transition authorization bill that got passed by the Senate. Looks like it's going to be passed by the House within the next couple of days. And that contains extremely strong language for Mars that, frankly, I believe it's the strongest, the most comprehensive language in support of human missions to Mars ever to be put in any piece of legislation. And that's probably going to be, you know, agreed to unanimously. So there's a lot of support within Congress, you know, for the goal of Mars. This doesn't mean we don't go other places. None of us think we're going directly there. Well, some of us do. But there will be intermediate steps. And so if we can find that right combination, you know, I think a lot of people should be happy. But we certainly seem to have a lot of momentum. And from what I've heard, you know, whatever you think of, you know, current administration, like them or not, sounds like, you know, they are interested in doing something ambitious in space exploration. So hopefully that is true and we can really start moving forward. We're well positioned.
Any insight on the NASA administrator, and will that person be pro-human to Mars?
You know what? I've spoken to a number of people that are being speculated about, you know, but I've heard the same rumors. You know, the same rumors that have been going on for many months, you know. So everybody I've spoken to, you know, they have different angles on this. But no, none of whom I've spoken to are opposed to sending humans to Mars. They're very supportive. It's just, you know, what is the pathway to get there? You know, and obviously the other destination that's spoken of the most is, you know, the moon. And we're not, generally speaking, opposed to going to the moon. We're certainly, you know, embrace it in, you know, utilizing cislunar space to get ready. Of course, the biggest challenge would be getting to the surface of the moon. And can we find, is it possible to find a way that we can get to the surface of the moon but not delay Mars, you know, by a long time, potentially decades, and do it in an affordable manner? We can find the right combination, that would be great. You know, I think none of us, you know, frankly, all of us want to do everything if we could. We had unlimited budgets, of course. We want to go everywhere and do everything. But, you know, we also are living in a realistic world with limited budgets, and we still don't know what the NASA budgets will be over the next few years. So our goal is to try to get us to Mars as efficiently and as soon as possible.
So if Musk is right and we are living in a simulation, we should be able to do everything, right?
That's true. If we're living in a simulator, it's not real money anyway.
That's right.
So why not just spend whatever we need to spend?
That's right. All
this, yeah, simulated finance.
That's one advantage of Elon's theory, but that doesn't seem to be catching on, does it?
No, you know.
Is humans to Mars? It's an international event, right? You have people from different countries, different space programs are all participating, right?
Yeah, and this year particularly, you know, the past few years, and this is our fifth Humans to Mars Summit. We've done some smaller conferences, more specifically focused on particular issues before that, but this is the fifth Humans to Mars Summit. And the previous years, while they had international participation, it was frankly, you know, not a lot. It was mostly focused on building interest within the United States, the public, but also the space stakeholders. And we did a very good job, you know, I believe, in kind of building support over the last few years. But this year, we wanted to make special effort to start building the international interest as well. There's a lot of differences of opinion, you know, about, you know, amongst our international partners on, you know, where we should focus. Obviously, we've heard about the Lunar Village concept. We've heard about other concepts. And we want to start trying to build up support with our international partners, you know, for the concept of sending humans to Mars. And I think one of the biggest ways to do this is if, as we move forward in this administration, the goal remains, you know, to send humans to Mars, I think that'll make a big difference, because I think a lot of our international partners have not been confident that we're going to stick with a plan for more than one administration, and I think there's good reason for this. So if we can continue the momentum we've built, I think that'll go a long way to show our potential international partners going to Mars or anywhere else that we will stick to our guns and we really intend to do this.
For this year, what are or who are some of the big name and impressive speakers you have, sort of the anchors for the event?
I'm going to try to remember off the top of my head. I'm bringing up my website right now. Once again, we have, of course, Buzz Aldrin coming, and always great to have Buzz talking. But we have a, you know, high-level NASA leadership again. We have, you know, the three associate administrators on a panel, you know, for human spaceflight, the science directorate and technology. We have other NASA speakers like Jim Green. But we also have people like Jim Cantrell from Vector Rocket. You know, you may recall Jim was one of those early people with SpaceX that helped Elon start SpaceX. We also have, you know, for people who watch the National Geographic Mars series, you know, we have the woman who played the physician in the drama half of that series, Clementine Poydance, and I apologize if I mispronounced her last name. Yeah, so she'll be there as well, kind of talking about her passion for Mars exploration that was non-existent before she was on the set of that Mars series. She's somebody who had no interest, had never really thought about it, but didn't really care about space exploration until she got on the set of the Mars series, and then she became, you know, she learned about it, was around people on the set that were extremely passionate, and was literally converted to be supportive and highly enthusiastic, like she found religion, you know. So she's now extremely passionate, and we have a lot of people like that, trying to bring in different types of people that aren't your usual traditional people coming to space exploration conferences.
Jerry is your first email question, Las Vegas, and he says, will you be streaming it live this year like you have in the past?
We will be. And we will be announcing the web address probably within the next few weeks. It'll be through live stream again, but I believe there's been a slight variation. They've made some adjustments, so I can't, you know, if you went to the same web address as last year, you'd probably get there, but I believe they're going to make some slight modifications. But that information will be announced within probably the next 3 weeks. And we're going to really hype that. We like to have people there live in person, but our online viewership has been huge. Between our broadcast and the recorded segments, we had over 1 million people that are viewed portions of the conference from last year, but we're trying to really push that up to more, try to get that well over, you know, 2 million if we can. We want to turn this truly into an international activity where people are watching around the world. There already are, but we want to build on that, you know, and get as many classrooms as possible. And we're going to try to find ways. Our bandwidth has always been limited, but we're going to try to find ways to truly be able to engage that international online audience a little bit better this year. We haven't been, I'll freely admit, we haven't necessarily been as good at engaging the online audience, you know, and, you know, at least actively ourselves. So we're going to try to find ways to do that as well. One other thing I wanted to actually mention, you know, one of the kind of topics we'll be talking about as well, you know, is, of course, looking at the various Mars architectures. You know, there are a lot of them out there. And one of the things we like to highlight, regardless how you know, what approach you support, you know, I know there's a lot of difference of opinion on, you know, whether we should use SpaceX or other, you know, more traditional approaches, or the Boeing or Lockheed approach. But I think that's what makes this impressive. There are so many corporations that are spending a lot of time and effort looking at different approaches. And so we want to highlight those, you know, so we're going to be looking at side by side all these different architecture concepts to show that there isn't any lack, it's not for a lack of thinking on this, lack of concepts for getting there. A lot of people are thinking about this. We just need to make a decision. And that's the key point, the key message. Now is the time to make decisions. What are we going to do? And what are we going to do next? You know, before we go to Mars, we have to figure out what we're doing next.
Are you going to be set up where people watching it live stream could ask questions?
We are. That's where we've had problems in the past. You notice we tend to pack our programming rather tight. And we often don't have much time for even audience questions, you know, people live there at GW.
Right.
So it's going to, what we're going to try to do, we will try to take occasional online questions, but we're also going to try to set up a system where we'll start answering questions and get some of the speakers to answer questions separately online as well. So it might not be answered right there on stage, but we're going to try to find ways to answer online questions on the side so that we, once again, so we can build that online interaction to make, you know, so you don't have to be there to be able to be engaged in the process.
Because, of course, I think you'll get inundated with questions coming from online, but hopefully you'll have a good screening process to work with that.
We always do get a lot of questions, and we will try to answer as many as we can. But, you know, we're setting up that system right now, so we do a better job than we have in the past.
Is there any chance in the future, I mean, even a slim to next to none chance, that you might locate Explore to Mars in different cities from year to year, rather always than Washington, D.C.?
There is a possibility. We are thinking about many options right now. I think Washington makes sense for the main conference.
Right.
We're likely to keep the annual May conference in Washington, D.C., but we are actively looking at various options for doing, you know, separate conferences, Humans to Mars conferences, and other, maybe occasionally in other cities in the United States. But we're also looking at some potential international places. We are currently working on potential conferences in Europe and in Asia at the moment. We haven't nailed down exactly when these will be, but we are looking at the prospect over the next few years of doing some international ones, as well as some other programming, certainly on the west coast of the United States, but perhaps other locations as well. So, yes, it just might not be exactly the same thing. Maybe they might be smaller, or we might take a specific subtopic and start focusing it on that in a particular region of the United States, particularly if it's highly relevant to that region of the United States.
Clark is in Tacoma, Washington, with email, and he says, Chris, I'm interested in understanding the absolute top or biggest or most crucial challenges for getting humans to Mars on a timely basis that there are, and how those challenges are being addressed. Is there a specific conference panel or discussion about the top priority challenges to overcome, or is that just generally discussed during multiple sessions at the event?
Yes, and let me kind of, this comes in two parts. I truly think the biggest obstacle is policy, maintaining a consistent policy forward. And that, of course, comes with budget as well. If we can make sure we can keep the policy moving forward and find a way to become more aggressive, I think nobody likes the pace we're going on. I think, from my perspective, that is the biggest obstacle. However, and we will be talking about that quite a bit during the conference. We're trying to scatter that throughout the conference this year. So we have policy people intermixed with other panelists to inject that policy angle when we're talking about the technologies as well. But I suspect the question was really geared towards the technology, the mission architecture, you know, and capabilities. And that, yeah, we will specifically, we'll be talking about that on each day. But day two of H2M is where we go into more specifics. If you go to the website right now, that's the day that has the fewest speakers listed. But over the next week, day two is going to be filled in quite a bit. And we will be talking about a lot of these different technologies and capabilities, as well as these tall pole technologies. And it's actually very timely because we ran a workshop, our fourth annual Mars Affordability and Sustainability Workshop in Pasadena back in December. And the primary focus of that was a look at tall poles. You know, we always get a little bit fixated on, you know, what rocket we're going to use and the crew vehicle. But there are a lot of other technologies and capabilities that are required to get there that we need to start working on pretty much now, you know, like entry, descent, and landing, Eclipse, surface power, ISRU, and other things like that. And so that was the focus of that workshop, and within the next few weeks we'll be releasing a 90-page report on that, going over that. That information is going to be integrated into the programming at H2M. So, not all of them, but a good number of these capabilities that really need to be addressed over the next few years will be talked about in detail, specifically on day two.
Ben is in Boston, and he says, keeping in line with that question, how do you legitimately or fairly or realistically assess our overall technology readiness level for getting humans to Mars, and where would you say it has to go to in order to get us to the point that we can have a firm date and a real plan?
And once again, let me step back a little, just give my background. Of course, I'm a policy guy, so I'm not going to try to go too far into the technology, but I do know it because I do this a lot.
Right.
But I think right now we have been thinking about this, looking at the problems for a long time. We are ready to make a decision and set a date. Will we make that date? I don't know. But we will not, I will be clear, we will not make that date unless we decide to go. And, you know, we have, you know, between all of these companies that I mentioned, you know, Boeing, Lockheed, Aerojet, Orbital, ATK have planned, SpaceX has a plan, other companies are developing plan, not all focused on Mars, but a lot of them are. And so I think, you know, if we start moving forward, that is the key. We're not going to solve all these issues until we've decided to do it. So we're not, you know, and as we go, we will figure out, you know, the questions of, you know, keeping people alive along the way. We will figure, we won't send people until we've figured out EDL. But I think, you know, when will we be ready to land on Mars? When we're ready to land on Mars? That's kind of a circular answer, but key part of this is making the decision. We are ready to make that decision now. You know, I think, you know, I'm probably stealing a line from Robert Zubrin right here, but we're much better ready, we're better prepared now to go to Mars today than we were of going to the moon back in the early 60s when Kennedy made his speech. It's right now, it's a key of just making the decision and moving forward, developing these capabilities.
So you don't think anything is too early in 2017 for setting dates and concrete plans? What I'm hearing from you is that this is sort of essential to get us on the docket, so to speak, even if that docket changes down the road.
Yeah, no, actually, and this is based on, once again, we do, as I mentioned, with these workshops, we do Affording Mars, the Sustainable Mars workshops. Most of the key stakeholders are there, the guys working on the architecture, as well as the science folks and everybody else. And most of them will tell you there are no deal killers here. There certainly are big challenges, but they're engineering challenges. We haven't figured them all out, but most people are pretty confident we will figure them out when we need to figure them out, but we have to actually have the decision to do it. You know, we will never do it if we wait around until we've solved all these issues before we make a decision to go. You actually need that motivation. You need a program, and you need, of course, the funding to do it. And whether that's the case, whether you're doing it through a more traditional government route or even a commercial route, you know, unless you've decided to do it, you're not going to figure these things out. And I think that's sometimes the problem we've had. People said, oh, we have to figure out all these issues. We have to figure out, you know, the radiation issue 100%. You know, you have to figure out this before we actually decide we're going to go. And, you know, I think that's a mistake, because that's pretty much guaranteeing we'll never go if we can't make a decision until we've figured out every problem we might counter along the way.
No, I totally agree with you. You've got a note from Jane in Tucson, and she says, I'm wondering if this is covered because I think it needs attention. There was an article several months ago in Real Clear Future, whatever that blog is, by someone named Rob Trzynski, that talked about how worthless and stupid the Musk going to Mars mission would be, as well as NASA going to Mars. And I'm wondering if you have anything devoted to countering bad press or to coming up with answers to people who criticize going to Mars, saying that it's not something that we should
do. It's not stupid?
We're not stupid, yeah. So basically,
no, right.
She's got a really long...
I'll counter that.
Yeah,
going to Mars is not stupid.
She's got a really long email.
Well, actually, it's good you mentioned that because, you know, you still see a few of these articles. And most of them, frankly, I'm not too concerned with them. I mean, we do need to counter them. But there are actually multiple things I'll use to answer your question because it's very timely. First off, of course, I believe looking at polling, we have strong support. You know, we have strong public support. We have strong congressional support. You know, we have strong industrial support. Yeah, I've never seen the level of support for Mars exploration we have right now. And this poll we released back in 2016 at the Humans to Mars Summit last year, we released this scientific poll. We didn't commission it. Another organization commissioned it, but we were the ones who released it. But it was a scientific poll, and it showed that 64% of Americans supported sending humans to Mars. And that was a little bit lower than the results we got from the poll we did back in 2013 that said 74% supported that. But they were two different types of polls. In that earlier poll, we provided budgetary context to show people that, you know, tell them what the percentage of the budget NASA received. And so I believe that's one of the main issues. Of course, people believe the NASA budget is much more than it is. When they realize it's less than half of 1% of the federal budget, most people are inclined to support it. It takes away that guilt factor. You know, if they believe that it's a choice between Social Security and Mars, Social Security is going to win every day. But, of course, it's not. It's not. It's like not even apples and oranges. It's apples and aircraft carriers. They're just not in the same category. But one of the things we're going to be releasing this year, and I'm pretty 98% sure we'll have it ready by H2M, we're working on a small publication called Why Mars. And so we will be having, you know, messaging, easily articulating the reasons why we should send humans to Mars, you know, in a more concise manner than the past. One of the biggest issues hasn't been that we haven't had good reasons for going to Mars. The problem has been we have too many good reasons for going to Mars, and the community often sounds confused or like it can't make up its mind because we have all these good, compelling reasons. You know, we went to the moon, we had one reason, to beat the Soviet Union. It was easy to understand. But once we had achieved that goal, we no longer had a reason to continue. It was not a sustainable program. However, right now, we have a lot of great reasons, and we have enough justification to create a sustainable program, but we need to do a better way of articulating that to the general public. So we will be releasing that information at the Humans to Mars Summit. It'll include the messaging. It'll also include these op-eds that we've been running in the Huffington Post over the last few months. I don't know if you've seen them. We ran a Why Mars, op-ed series with people from different disciplines, from science, from engineering, from entertainment, from STEM education, getting different opinions on why we should support sending humans to Mars. So we will be releasing that, but we are also about to launch an additional op-ed series, really hitting on these issues as well. But one last comment on this, which I like using, and we're also creating some messaging on this, kind of put some of these statistics in place as well, which is part of the Why Mars argument, that, as I mentioned, since NASA is less than half 1% of the budget, you know, if you look at all of the NASA budgets combined since 1958 till present, even that accounts for one-third of a single year of entitlement spending. And it's not an argument about entitlements, but it's interesting to see that every NASA budget combined is equal to one-third of a single year of entitlement spending. So it really isn't a matter of, you know, this isn't adding dramatically to our national debt. It's not a choice between Social Security and Mars. And to be perfectly honest, you know, we're going to probably spend roughly the same amount on NASA whether we send people to Mars or not over the next 20 years. So why not spend that money on sending people, doing something bold and sending people to Mars? Sorry for that long-winded answer.
Well, I mean, you're 100% right, but get that into the mindset of our members of Congress. That's another story.
Yeah, and we are, and we're trying to find better ways of doing it with that document, but we're trying to put some of these things, more of this stuff on paper, and trying to respond whenever we see some of these articles. Like there was another piece in the L.A. Times, I think, like a couple days ago, which was essentially calling the concept of sending humans to Mars stupid or something like that.
Well, the L.A. Times thinks open borders is brilliant, so what can I tell you? Sorry.
I'll hold my commentary on that.
That's right. So if it were open borders with the aliens coming from Mars and wherever, I'd be all for it because I'd really like to meet an extraterrestrial. But that's probably not going to happen.
Hopefully they're nice.
Well, I think they will be, but I do know there's a school of thought out there that they will eat us. So I have no inside information on that, but I just want to believe that they're going to be nice and helpful and give us all sorts of cool technology and answers and shine bright lights on us, and it's just going to be kumbaya all the way through the solar system. So
I hope you're right.
I hope I live long enough to find out.
Yeah, unless they're planning on eating you.
So. Peggy is in Billings, Montana, and says, Chris, since you are such an elegant spokesperson for going to Mars and why we should be going to Mars, assume you got stuck in an elevator with President Trump for 3 to 5 minutes. What would you say to him?
Well, with President Trump, I think, you know, pushing the arguments that this is something that truly can make America great. You know, and this isn't just kind of lip service. I believe this is one of these areas where we have the lead in it. You know, the United States isn't behind in space exploration. We have so many resources we can put to bear on this, and it's not something that would break the budget. And it impacts so many areas. First off, we can show the United States is capable of these great things, and that will inspire the world. No matter what people think of U.S. foreign policy, the world loves space exploration and loves NASA and the commercial activities going on in the United States. It is a tremendous diplomatic tool. But not only that, of course, it will stimulate the economy. It impacts technology, but it also impacts national morale. And when national morale improves, that has a direct impact on the overall viewpoint of the country if we're moving ahead, and that impacts the economy. So I really think we can make a very strong argument to the president that this not only is good for, you know, nationalism in general, but it really is good for the overall outlook of the country, the economy, and how the rest of the world views us. So it's one of the least expensive ways of making America great again.
This looks like another email day, but listeners, the phone line is 1-866-687-7223. Tim is in New York, and he says, Chris, over the past year, David has devoted significant time to the discussion of planetary protection in Article 6 of the Outer Space Treaty, and many people think that human flight to Mars will be thwarted by Article 6 and planetary protection, at least for the foreseeable future, maybe even for longer. How do you see it, and does your Humans to Mars event address planetary protection in a serious way and show how humans to Mars can still go to Mars, even to desirable locations, not the frigid poles?
Good question. And yes, we are going to have, I'll start with the conference, we will be talking about planetary protection. We're also pondering a more robust panel on that right now. That hasn't been decided yet, planetary protection will be integrated throughout the throughout some of the sessions. But you are very right. This is a big problem. It's a big issue. It's a legitimate one. We do have to think about planetary protection. We don't want to contaminate Mars, and we don't want Mars to contaminate our planet. But with the current rules, we could not send humans. With the current rules that are in place, we couldn't possibly. Humans are, of course, big bags of microbes, you know. So, you know, the current rules would not allow a human to go with, you know, right now. But we have to start thinking about that and, you know, how we're going to be able to find a way to, not, on one hand, protect, you know, not completely contaminate Mars, but on the other hand, be able to actually send humans near the interesting stuff. So right now, because that's two things, you know, we want to send humans to places where they might have life that are scientifically interesting, but those are also the places that have resources. And general thinking right now is we want to do ISRU. We want to put people near places with the resources that can keep the people alive, that can create where they can access water and create oxygen and methane fuel, et cetera. And so, but those happen to be a lot of the same places that might have life. And so, and that we don't want to contaminate. So we really have to start an aggressive discussion. I think we will find a way of doing it. I truly do, but we really have to start this question, this discussion, somewhat aggressively right now and figure out the right approach. Maybe the solution is to kind of, to, you know, protect certain areas of Mars while we actually send humans to other interesting parts of Mars. You know, maybe that's the right compromise, or maybe there's another compromise. But you're absolutely correct. That has to be discussed. We have to find a good compromise on this. Otherwise, we cannot send humans to Mars because with the current rules.
Well,
so hopefully we'll figure that out, but I think we will.
Elon talks about his timeline and everything. Have you ever had a talk with him about this? Is he planning on achieving a compromise or circumventing whatever the rules are and just doing what he wants to? Of course, he won't get a launch license to do what he wants to do, but it would seem to me that to have an aggressive time frame with a date and all of that, when this is such a key issue that may or may not be resolved by then, is pretty iffy.
Well, it is, and this is actually something, and it's not just the big colony vehicle plans that Elon has. That's an entirely different matter. I'll get to that in a second. You know, sending 100 people at once, that creates a whole bunch of different problems. But let's move that in a little bit. Of course, Elon wants to send the Red Dragons to Mars. And, you know, that's been pushed back. The first one's been pushed back to 2020. But even still, if that's successful, that's a larger vehicle that's ever landed than has ever landed on Mars in the past. And so that brings up a lot of planetary protection issues in itself. So from what I've heard from people I've spoken to at SpaceX, they are communicating with NASA, talking with the planetary protection people, but I'm not privy to too many of the details of this. I hear that they're doing it, that they are working with them to find the right solutions to do this, but I don't know much beyond that, except this is something that, you know, it might be something that'll force the issue, you know, as we move forward. If SpaceX starts landing, you know, 5-ton, you know, Dragon capsules on Mars, that might actually stimulate the conversation. And that maybe that's just what we need, to start really kind of forcing the issue.
Why don't we have...
We can't wait until the last second to have this discussion. We can't be on the verge of sending humans and all of a sudden have some major outcry or court action or something to prevent people from going.
Yeah, but why can't we have leaks where it really matters and we want to get the information out? But that just doesn't seem to happen with these guys. We don't get to hear what their private conversations are about.
This is true.
They got better better security than the U.S. government, that's for sure.
yes.
Bijan is over in Sweden, and he says, I bet the president in that stuck elevator would question your hypothesis like this. If Apollo had such a great effect on the overall society, how come the 1970s were such a low point for the U.S. economically, socially, and militarily?
Well, I suppose it's a good question, but you can also say that the Apollo program, you know, doubled the number of science and engineering degrees in the Apollo program. You can draw a direct line from the Apollo program to the growth, the creation and the growth of Silicon Valley. You know, it, not only the technology that came out of it, but also a lot of the people.
Also,
you know, a lot of those folks were inspired. Of course, a lot of that early stuff, activity in Silicon Valley, was, you know, motivated by miniaturization for the Apollo program. So that helped to get, it wasn't the only thing, but it really helped to get it going. But think of all these Silicon Valley billionaires out there that were inspired by Apollo, you know, that it truly got inspired to go into engineering and things like that and computer science, you know, because they were inspired by Apollo and then made their billions, transformed the world, but now they're coming back and created their own space programs because, you know, the U.S. space program wasn't moving fast enough for them. I think the 70s was a challenging time, but I think that was had nothing to do with, I think that would have happened with or without the Apollo program. I think we can show very clear benefits that came from Apollo throughout the world. And I think we probably would have been much worse off in the 70s and well beyond if it hadn't been for that.
Well, right, and we need to keep in mind that it wasn't designed as an economic or a social program. It was designed to defeat the Soviet Union in the Cold War, and it did that. So Apollo was very, very successful for what it was intended to do. It wasn't really even intended to be a space program. That's just the way they chose to beat the Soviet Union in the Cold War.
Yeah, and that's and once again, and we had a great motivation for doing it, but you know, it was not a sustainable program because I don't think people, the overall policy people, I don't think understood a lot of the elements of how important this was beyond beating the Soviet Union.
No, it stopped there.
I think one thing is clear. We learned from it. You know, trying to recreate the Apollo program or recreate that Kennedy moment, I think, is a mistake because it was not a sustainable program. I think you can take lessons from it, have elements of that, but we do have to find a much more sustainable way of doing things to make sure it's not just sending, you know, nobody wants to, you know, send people to Mars or back to the moon and just once again put down the flags and footprints, et cetera. If we're going to go, we want to do it permanently, sustainably, and just continue going.
Absolutely. Chris, we're at the midway point. I'm going to pause us for a couple of minutes, and listeners, we'll come back in 3 minutes. For those of you who do want to call, we answer the phone during the break. It is 1-866-687-7223, and email will continue drspace@thespaceshow.com. We'll be back in about 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax-deductible. This is with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to part two of our Sunday Space Show program. And we're talking about Mars, Explore Mars, and the Humans to Mars big event coming up with Chris Carberry, who is the CEO of Explore Mars. We do have a couple of sponsors for this segment of the program as well. So the AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, is a sponsor. They're the world's largest aerospace pro society. And they have over 30,000 individual members, 88 countries are represented, 95 corporate members, and they are busy shaping the future of aerospace every day, advancing the state of aerospace science and technology, and increasing our knowledge of the universe and bringing the world closer together. Do check them out, and they are at AIAA.org. Orbital ATK is also a sponsor. They are known as the global leader in aerospace and defense technologies, the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And then Celestis is one of our sponsors, and they are the pioneer global leader in Memorial Spaceflight Services. This has been a fact since 1995. And they now have partnered with CG Labs of Canada, and they have an opportunity to fly DNA into space. So if your loved one who has passed has wants a traditional burial, you can still send their DNA to space. This is a new program. And you can include some of your own DNA on that flight with your loved one or your best friend. So thanks to this partnership with CG Labs, they are the world leader in DNA collection. Personal space flight options have been expanded beyond just sending a couple of grams of ashes of your loved one into space. Also, you can store your DNA off-planet through the Celestis Lunar and Deep Space missions, and they give you a kit that you can also use to store DNA at home. And as I said, families choosing traditional burial now have a way to also send part of their loved one to space and alongside of your DNA as well. So Celestis is the only one doing this, and their website, celestis.com, for more information. And remember, I am their customer, so all disclosure here, transparency. I have sent my mom and my dogs into space through Celestis, including some DNA for one of the dogs. And they're one of the finest companies I've ever worked with in my life. I love the people dearly. And I can't say I want to keep working with them because it means someone close to me has passed away, so that's not a good thing. But these people are really terrific, and they're sensitive and caring, and they're wonderful and efficient. Boy, that's a strange word for businesses today. And you will love being in business with Celestis. I know that's weird for a memorial company to say that, but they're really it's a great opportunity and with great people. Chris, maybe they'll be able to send people's DNA or ashes to Mars in the not-so-distant future if they have reliable transportation.
Yeah, maybe. Pretty cool. I hadn't heard of them, actually, so I'll have to look them up. Sounds like a really cool service.
Well, they've done stuff to the moon, but, you know, they need a good ride to Mars. So I think they have something for Mars planned, but getting there is still a bit of an upward tick.
Yeah, well, hopefully over the next decade or two, that'll cease to be a problem.
Absolutely. You have a caller on hold. Hi, caller. This is John from Fort Worth. So welcome back to the show, John. What's on your mind, please?
Well, I just sort of that, one of the things I heard was that last, I think the question that came in was the idea that somehow the knocking, it was some one way it was sort of knocking the space program because of what happened in the 70s in the U.S. Is somehow almost implying the space program was a negative impact or something.
Well, he's talking, and actually I have a follow-up email from him that I haven't read yet. But no, I'll just read his note again. I don't think he was knocking the space program. He's just saying it really didn't provide a lot of economic and social benefits for the 70s, and of course that wasn't its purpose. He said, I bet the president in that stuck elevator would question your hypothesis like this. If Apollo had such a good effect on the overall society, how come the 70s were such a low point for U.S. economically, socially, and militarily?
Well, I don't think the space program was a negative in any way on that. I think there were other factors that drove the 70s, including the increased oil prices.
The Vietnam War, how about that?
Well, it had pretty much ended by the 70s, too. I mean, you know, it was a dominant thing in the late 60s to maybe 71 or so. But after it was downsizing rapidly.
Yeah,
so.
But the effects on the economy were already there in a tailspin at that point. So.
Then you, of course, had the oil crisis and everything. So there were a whole bunch of things that converged in that early part of the 70s that contributed to that. And, the moon certainly didn't add to it. I think, if anything, it probably removed some of the hardships, or at least the public feeling about the country. I think it was one of the few good things at the time. I think the economic benefits, there were a lot of them, but a lot of them took a little while to really, be noticed throughout society. But I think, that was one of the few good things we could point to during that time frame. And it's something that brought the entire world together, and there aren't too many things you could have pointed to at that time period.
Yeah. Well, I thought that was an interesting slant, although the other comment I heard, which I kind of also tended to disagree with a little bit, is the idea, the space program led to us winning the Cold War. I mean, we won the moon race, obviously, but I think that that was something that was more a little bit later in the development, actually the Soviet side, the communists, whatever, was doing quite great in the 70s, actually, after that. It was really in the 80s where they seemed to just sort of maybe have effectively a cultural heart attack or something and died. and of course, I have my own theory on the fall of the Soviet Union, which is more the fact that they didn't have a decent retirement program for their senior officials, and so they simply would stay in office and they literally died of some kind of illness. And as such, the leadership by the late 70s and early 80s simply was too ineffective to actually govern and make bold decisions anymore. They simply sat there holding on to their office, and their wives definitely wanted to maintain their housing and benefits, and he couldn't retire without just basically being stuck off in some little apartment somewhere. So essentially, nobody did. They just died in office, and their whole system imploded around them. It's a novel theory, but it's not ideological. It's very practical.
Chris, any comment?
Well, I enjoy talking about Soviet politics also and the reasons for the fall of the Soviet Union, but I don't want to go too far down that path. But I agree that I think the moon, us beating the Soviet Union to the moon, played a role. But, yeah, there were a lot of other factors, and many of them came later in the 80s, late 70s, early 80s. There were a lot of things that contributed to that, but I'd rather not go too far into that. It's going to get us away from space.
Of course not. I just thought I'd throw that out. It's one of my pet theories, though. Now I don't hear anybody actually saying that, but I think that there's an argument to it. On the moon, one thing on the Mars thing and the NASA budget, though. I really don't know that we can have a viable Mars program within the same NASA budget we have now. without basically sacrificing practically everything else we're doing, at least in human space. I mean, a Mars program is going to cost a lot of money. I mean, I think we should face up to we need a bigger budget if we're going to do the things we really want to do, like go to Mars, for instance.
Well, no, that's true. We do need a bigger budget, but not as much more, not that, we won't need as much of a budget increase as you'd think. You know, there, you know, once again, as I mentioned earlier in the program, we've done these Mars affordability and sustainability workshops, and the first one we did was pretty much trying to bring the community together and have them agree, can we do this affordably? It was first off, should this be the goal, and whether we can do it, whether it's feasible. But the primary question was, could we do it affordably? And that was the most complicated question. And it took a while for this community to come together. But actually looking at all the different architecture plans that are out there and, you know, how people are approaching, you know, these plans, the group finally agreed that we can do it affordably, but we just can't do things exactly the way we've done them before. And so,
guys, we
most
have
people agree we will require some level of budget increase for NASA, of course, certainly inflationary, but certainly something beyond that as well. But the consensus generally is it won't take much more. It's not the budget hasn't been the biggest issue. It's been consistency of policy. And so I'm not, for instance, this plan that JPL, the Planetary Society, helped sponsor a couple of years ago, showing that we could go to Mars without any increases at all except for inflationary, was an interesting exercise. It showed that we could actually do this. I don't agree with that plan. I don't think it's aggressive enough. I think we do need to go faster than what they said. But I think it's a matter of just figuring out the right approach. Yes, kind of engaging with international partners and the commercial sector and finding that right balance. But most plans out there should not require a major increase in budget. We will need to get beyond the International Space Station, though. We will need to free up funds from that.
Guys, we have a secret weapon that none of you are paying attention to.
What might that be?
President Trump can negotiate all the Mars contracts, and then we'll save a ton of money.
I hadn't thought of that. Okay.
So, I mean,
problem solved.
That's why he's president. So,
yes.
So you need to promote this at your conference to get him. That's what you say in the elevator with him. You tell him that with him negotiating all the Mars contracts for NASA, this will be slam dunk and very cost effective, and it will make America great again.
Okay, I'll take that under advisement.
And
should I actually end up stuck in an elevator with President Trump?
That's well better than the Russian ambassador, Chris. So,
yeah.
John, what else from you on the serious side? I've gotten my sarcasm over with for the day. So,
okay. That's an interesting idea, though, have Trump negotiate it.
I'm being sarcastic. Please don't take me seriously here. So.
Oh, we never take you serious, David.
He's a good negotiator, though. I mean, I don't know.
Chris, I'm turning it over to you. I shouldn't open these doors with John because I know exactly what he's going to do. But anyway, what else, John?
Well, I don't know. I guess the thing is, I still see that. I mean, there seems to be a big gap between the alternatives of basically, completing the SLS, the full version of it, and using that to go to Mars, or sort of saying, okay. Let's go to the commercial space and have them bid on what it would take to build a Mars vehicle and see if Elon or Bezos could get a cheaper version. I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's two totally different radical ways of looking at the world, I think.
Well, I don't think they have to be, and this is where I generally come from. I'm certainly a big supporter of stimulating commercial, but I'm also, you know, I generally also see a lot of value in continuing forward with SLS. I think if we find the right balance, you know, both are going to play a key role. I certainly see a key role for SpaceX and Blue Origin, as well as Boeing, Lockheed, Aerojet, Orbital ATK, and all the others, just finding the right approach. And sometimes, and this is where I like coming together, I want to find the most efficient way forward that's not only feasible from a budgetary perspective, but also politically feasible as well. And, you know, the cheapest option isn't necessarily the most politically realistic option. And so it's finding the right approach. Right now, there is a tremendously, you know, a tremendous amount of support in Congress for SLS and Orion. And, you know, a tremendous amount of support for Mars, as I mentioned. And so I think, you know, by saying that even if Trump decided to say, oh, we're going to go, you know, and stimulate, you know, contract SpaceX or Blue Origin, that wouldn't necessarily happen because they would be pushed back from Congress. As we saw back when, for instance, when President Obama announced his space plan back in 2010, you know, he made a fairly grand announcement about things, but Congress pushed back, and that was both Republicans and Democrats because they didn't necessarily like the approach he was taking. So I see the same. I think there's actually more unity in Congress right now. And so I think the key will be, you know, finding the right way of integrating these commercial players in this overall approach. If they decide to do it, fund it themselves, that's great. You know, I'm all for that. If SpaceX or Blue Origin or others can find a purely commercial approach, great. That's very exciting. I hope they can do it. But if we're assuming that this is going to come from, you know, through NASA, at least the funding through NASA, government funding largely, I think it's going to need to be a hybrid approach, a more, you know, involving both SLS Orion as well as commercial players, you know, SpaceX and the Dragons and the vehicles that Blue Origin are creating right now as well, and finding the right mix. And over time, you know, I'm sure things will play out and different vehicles will be chosen that make more sense over time. But I find it difficult to believe it's all of a sudden going to go one direction or another.
Well, I can see that, but I mean, I'm just saying that's such a dichotomy that I think you almost have to choose one or the other. And I mean, I don't see how you develop SLS and at the same time fund some completely alternative thing. And weirdly enough, probably the commercial people are probably better on the basic launch vehicles than they really would be on things like the landers and that stuff. I mean,
I disagree. I mean, I get what you're saying, and I'm going to get back to the lander and everything else. But right now, I mean, I'm not saying that we have to choose, you know, we do have to choose which direction we're going, but that doesn't exclude either player. It means we're not necessarily, for instance, if we're staying with SLS and Orion, yes, we're not going to rely on some other launch vehicles for certain things. Doesn't mean we're not going to use, you know, Falcon 9 Heavy or other vehicles, you know, to play a key role. It doesn't, you know, SLS isn't necessarily going to launch everything. It's not going to necessarily launch all the astronauts. You know, but going to entry, descent, landing, well, SpaceX is currently working on supersonic retropropulsion. And so they are, you know, they're utilizing or developing some interesting technology, some key technology for that. And if they start landing Red Dragons, well, that's relevant, certainly relevant technology for landing. So I see there's a lot of elements from both sides that could be utilized. But we do have to make a decision how we're moving forward and then figure out if there's a way to integrate, you know, both. And I think there is. I think we'll figure that out. But, you know, I could be wrong as well.
Oh, well. Anyway, I guess I'll get off and see if we can get somebody else to call in.
John, do you let me ask you a question, because
okay.
I know you're big on SLS and wanting to return to the moon and everything.
Yeah.
How do you see the focus and the attention to be split on Mars and the moon? Do you think it's a 50-50 deal, or do you think Mars should be getting more attention or less than the moon gets? I'm just curious to see how you think the proper mix is for that.
Well, I mean, I guess it's probably a budgetary thing, but my basic viewpoint is that there's so many issues about a Mars mission. I mean, a lot of them have been discussed earlier here. I mean, we didn't even get into human factors and human, you know, endurance for that period of time it would take with the basic chemical rocket propulsion technology approach to get to Mars and back and do the mission on Mars and, you know, all that stuff that That's why I tend to favor going to the moon. Is, you know, right now, I mean, we're barely relying on the Russians just to get into orbit. I'd like to get us back to, you know, where we're really doing something like landing on another body, and the moon is a lot easier. You know, and also, I mean, that would probably include developing either the SLS Orion and a lander or something else. And then once that's going, the key thing on SLS economy, for instance, is getting the production rates up to where you build enough of them that you're not doing one every 2 years or something, you know. So so if you have a robust moon program, then I think you're in a jump-off point that where maybe then you can start talking Mars. You know, that's just my personal but.
Okay, I was just curious. Chris, do you have anything else for John, or are we ready to move on?
I think we're ready to move on. You know, I think you know my opinion. I think, you know, and I, as I said earlier, I'm not, if we can find the right way of going to the moon, that's great, but I don't believe it's actually, it's necessary, it's not a necessary step to going to Mars. We can find a way of doing it, yeah, that can be some benefit, but really isn't one of those necessary steps. And, yeah, we'd have to figure out those human factors, yes, but many of them, you know, we actually have a lot of information on, you know, the physiology, you know, on the lack of gravity. You know, I've spoken to a number of astronauts who have mentioned that, you know, sometimes, you know, as long as you stick with the exercise regimen, you don't have that major bone loss and musculature loss. There are a lot of ways you can counteract that. It's not perfect, but they're pretty confident it's not going to be a major issue. You know, there's the radiation issues as well, but, you know, at least for the ordinary background radiation, you know, when they sent the MSL there, you know, they realized it wasn't as bad as some had thought it would be, and so it should be manageable. And so there are a lot of other things. I think ECLIS, you know, that technology, you know, creating a life support and things related to keeping the astronauts alive, that is a challenge, and we have to figure it out. But I'm pretty confident, based on what I've heard, they will actually figure that out. And we are going to the moon. It's just whether we're landing. There's a lot of universal belief we should be at least in cislunar space. And so if we're getting there, there are a lot of players who want to go to the surface of the moon. I think there have been a lot of great offers. If we're going, you know, into lunar orbit fairly, hopefully sooner than later, you know, if there are commercial players and international players who want to build a lander and get us down to the surface, that is terrific. We're all for that.
All right. John, I will talk to you later, okay?
Just fine. Okay.
Thank you for your call in. Listeners, that opens the phone up for your calls, and we do want to hear from you. 1-866-687-7223. So Bijan sent in a follow-up, which I took John's call first, but this was a follow-up to the end of the first segment, and so we're going to get to it now. We're a little behind the eight ball on that. And Bijan says, my point is that if one promises too much magic to spin off from the space program, one risk losing credibility. I think that space exploration needs to be argued for based on its own merit rather than speculating about effects on the economy or education. Everything has let me read it. Everything has unforeseen spin-offs that is in no way an argument for space flight specifically, except Bijan. There are facts supporting the economic benefit of space and education and the spinoffs. That's not speculation and the technology that came out of that program. But I'll turn it over to our guest today, Chris, and let him answer to you.
But I agree with you. I mean, that's not speculation. It will happen. We can't say, you know, what sort of miracles will come in technology by going to Mars. We know they'll come. We'll know, you know, obviously the technology is needed to go there will stimulate a lot of innovation. And we know it'll stimulate STEM education. We know it'll really inspire the world. We've seen that, you know, it's a great diplomatic tool as well. I mean, tremendous diplomatic tool. And we actually have a panel on diplomacy and space exploration at Humans to Mars Summit also. We should be filling out that panel over the next week. But it's not just that, you know, we were, you know, during the question, I think it was specifically, what would I say to Trump? And I think from this administration, you know, articulating the economic benefits, you know, innovation, things like that, I think, you know, certainly a good argument, you know, if I were in an elevator with Trump. But there are also a lot of other reasons. You know, the science is highly compelling. You know, Mars is certainly the most interesting scientific location that people can be sent to. And humans being there, you know, particularly if we can figure out these planetary protection issues, are going to be vital. You know, one human crew is going to do in just a few weeks more than all of our rovers have done in years. Far more efficient. We're going to be able to figure out if humans can live on another planet. We'll be able to probably figure out a lot of these scientific issues much faster, much more efficiently than with robots. So we'll just figure out if humans can live on another planet. We don't know that for sure. You know, we're assuming we can, but we have never sent people we've sent people for short excursions to the moon. We've never sent people to Mars, which is actually a planetary body that's actually much more suitable for human life, but we still don't know if we could keep people alive there. So there are a lot of good reasons. This is why I mentioned our Why Mars effort. We're trying to develop the messaging to simplify all these reasons in a much easier way to understand so that, you know, we don't have to go through the laundry list of 500 reasons, and there are those reasons, but it makes it sound like we're not decisive or we can't make up our minds. So there are a tremendous number of reasons, not just economic and scientific and STEM and many, and frankly national security as well. Even though we have a civilian space agency, I think most people will agree that it's actually probably a good thing for us to stay ahead in space exploration and technologies required for doing it. I don't think we want to fall at all behind or that far behind in these technologies. I think people can understand that it's a good thing to stay ahead with these technologies.
One thing we have learned is that no matter how beneficial and cool the spinoffs are, they don't sell the space program. So in that sense, Bijan is right. You can't seem to get better funding and more people interested by promoting the spinoffs. That just, for whatever reason, has never caught on.
No, I think it's a lot of that. I think national morale is one that does. But I think when we did our poll back in 2013, the reason the highest percentage of people said the reason we should go to Mars was for knowledge of Mars or science. We were actually surprised at that. We expected it to be national morale or something else, you know, or one of those things like economy. But the number one reason was, I can't remember what percentage it was, but it was actually for science, to understand Mars. And so I think a wide range of things. I think different people come at it from different reasons. You speak to, like, when I go to speak to Congress, we have a lot of support for space exploration in Congress, but you'd be surprised at the diversity of reasons why people support it in Congress. And I think they're kind of a microcosm for society. I think there are a lot of different reasons why people support space exploration. Not everybody has to support it for the same reason, but there are sufficient reasons to cover all of society. And I think that's the great thing about space exploration in general, and particularly Mars exploration. I think there's enough of it. There are enough compelling reasons that everybody can find, as long as they are given the proper information and the proper statistics. I think there is enough information and reasons out there to satisfy practically anybody. There are always going to be people who try to argue that it's not, we don't want to do it, but I think we actually have enough compelling reasons to convince, and I think we have a large percentage, a majority of the population.
Have you noticed in your Humans to Mars programming and support a gender difference in interest in going to Mars, or a significant gender interest in the different reasons for going to Mars with people?
Well, let me start off with the gender difference in overall support. And here I would actually refer to the two polls that I was mentioning earlier. whereas we have the demographic information for both, for the 2013 and the 2016 poll. And the support for Mars was consistent across all demographics. You know, men and women generally were equal in their support for Mars. And the same thing, it pretty much covered also different demographics as well, like for education, for ethnicity, and what was the other thing? Income was the other one that was actually looked at. And as for reasons, I can't recall if our poll actually went into that, you know, with at least, you know, for gender differences. I have heard anecdotally, you know, some differences, but I wouldn't be able to tell you. I wouldn't want to talk with authority on, you know, women prefer going to Mars for these reasons and men prefer going to Mars for those reasons. But that's an interesting reason. I know there are subtle differences, but I'm not confident enough, you know, in those differences to actually start hypothesizing.
All right. So we'll leave that. Do you have any bigger challenges getting one gender or another for your event? Do you try to balance it out, or do you how do you work with ethnics and gender in terms of putting your Human to Mars event together, or do you not pay attention to it and just let it fall out naturally among those?
We pay attention to it. We try to, you know, it's always a challenge. You know, we always try to make sure to have, you know, as diverse, you know, have as many women participating as possible and men, and, you know, as diverse. But once again, it does take some effort because, you know, a lot of times, you know, when these things are coming together, you will find that it often will end up, you look at it, well, that's an awful lot of middle-aged white guys. And, you know, but that's been changing over time. There are a lot of women. There are a lot of, you know, there's a lot of diversity in the space community, particularly Mars. You know, as you recall, probably a few years ago, we did a conference called Women and Mars, and that was stimulated because myself and a former NASA official were speaking in her office prior to that, and we had, you know, both of us had perception, at least. We didn't know if it was anecdotal or not, but there were a lot more women in Mars science and the Mars community than in other areas of space exploration. And we weren't sure if that was true or not, or just, you know, just anecdotal or something that we had perceived that wasn't accurate. But we did a whole conference on the topic. So we've always been thinking about that, making sure we can find ways to bring more women in and more, different groups in, you know, to make it more diverse. But we have a long way to go, and we're always looking for ways of doing that, bringing in new groups to help the whole community diversify, because I think that's essential. I think, you know, when we truly start exploring space and settling space, we want, you know, all humanity to come along.
Did you verify if there were more women involved in Mars work than men? Was that ever something that you could verify?
It was, you know, after that big spiel about whether we were going to verify, I don't think we verified it, but we did show there were an awful lot of, you know, very impressive women in Mars science, engineering, policy, and it was not difficult to put a whole conference together based on that. And so I can't say that we came out with definitive proof that we didn't do actually any market research. We didn't do any polling, but it was clear that there was a lot of women involved in Mars exploration, but we did not answer that question, interestingly.
Go through the logistics real quick, because we are close to the end of the program today. So this is in Washington, D.C. Do you have a hotel that's designated for the conference, or do you just stay close to George Washington University?
Well, we do. The thing is, you know, the problem with doing it at George Washington University, of course, it's not at a hotel, and none of the hotels are too close. There are some nearby, you know, near George Washington University, of course, but, you know, it's the one our conference hotel is the Holiday Inn, which is actually technically across the river at Roslyn, one metro station away. You know, if we were in the hotel, that would be a different matter, but, you know, this is the one we've done for the last few years. But logistically, you know, it's at the Lisner Auditorium at George Washington University. We'll be starting off the day before with a few preliminary activities, including a screening of Pascal Lee's documentary called Passage to Mars, and we'll have a panel discussion with Pascal that evening as well. And then we're going to have a workshop right before that looking at called iGiant, the series of workshops that looking at gender differences in technology and space exploration and things like that on that topic. You know, and then we'll start the conference on May 9th, you know, with, you know, right off the bat with really impressive lineup of speakers. You know, the first day we try to focus on the public a little more, so it's faster paced. Not quite TED Talk set up, but, you know, in that spirit, trying to keep it fast paced, you know, so that ordinary people, the press, students, we try to bring in a lot of students on the first day, you know, can understand it, so we don't go too far into the technical details. And then in the evening, we'll also have a session as well with risk, you know, talking about risk and space exploration. You know, day two goes more into technical detail, focusing more on the space community, you know, going into those technologies like those tall pole issues and the more detail in the mission architecture plans as well as science. Then day three, we're going to, you know, it's a half day, but we're really going to try to load up some really top-level programming that day. We're going to have, you know, a session on, that's when we have our diplomacy and space exploration talk. But we're also going to have a session looking at, talking about that lunar issue. You know, do we need to land, is landing on lunar surface necessary for going to Mars? And so we're putting together a debate on the topic. So we just kind of talk about it openly and have, you know, good people on each side and have a debate. And so, and then we're going to finish off with a big speaker at the end, and then we hop off and go off to Capitol Hill. So,
do you have like a banquet or any social activities?
Yes, we do. We have a speaker's lunch the second day at the City View Room at GW, beautiful view of the Washington Monument. Jim Cantrell will be speaking there. We have first night reception on site, which is always a big one, and so we're hoping, you know, have a lot of people at that reception at the Lisner Auditorium. Then we will have an off-site reception the second night, and we'll be announcing the location for that within the next 2 weeks. But it's always a nice location. Last year we did it at a nice location, rooftop location with this beautiful view of the also of the Washington Monument. And you know, we always had a Scotch tasting at it, and we usually have a lot of interesting things like that. We're hoping to do that again. And, you know, at the lunch, annual lunch, we also usually have a wine sponsor. We will this again this year. Greg Olson, you know, the private astronaut, also has his own vineyard in South Africa, and he's provided the wine each year for the last several years for our lunch.
Interesting. And people can register now for the conference, and all of that is available
now,
online.
They go to h2m.exploremars.org. There will be a lot of information going up on the agenda in the next few days, next couple of weeks certainly. You'll see a lot of those open spaces filled in. We'll be opening up secondary registration. If they go, they'll notice they can't register for things like the lunch or the one of the receptions yet, but that secondary registration will open up definitely within the next 3 to 4 weeks. We usually try to do that at the beginning of April.
Okay, let me think if there's anything else that the listeners should really need to know about or anything like that. I guess what I should say is there anything that we should have talked about that we've forgotten to cover or that you wanted to be sure to get out to people about the event?
Oh, I'm sure there is, but I can't figure it right now. There's always an endless number of topics we could talk about.
Can people, if they think they have something that they want to say or contribute, can they become a speaker at the conference?
It's getting pretty tight right now, but feel free to email me at carberry@exploremars.org. Even if we don't do it this year, we're always looking for topics. And, you know, once again, we're looking at doing things in other parts of the country as well. So if you have a topic, you know, let me know. And, you know, it may not get in this year. As I said, we're getting pretty tight. There's a possibility it will also. But we're always looking for programming, whether it be at the Humans of Mars Summit, or other places.
Okay. Well, we will look forward to talking to you some more about this and getting off our butts and going to Mars and getting something going, and we'll see how the planning turns out for this year politically, and maybe we'll touch base toward the end of the year and see if you're happy or disappointed or still waiting for the big announcement.
Yeah, well, hopefully we'll hear something. Hopefully I'm happy, but we'll see. You know, at some point they're going to have to turn to space, and we'll see where it goes. Hopefully it's good news for everybody.
And that's a good way to close. So, Chris, thank you for returning to the Space Show. We'll talk to you soon, and I will get this archived and get you all the information. And I look forward to paying attention on the streaming. I won't be able to attend again this year due to...
You're going to have to get there some year.
Yeah,
you know,
well...
Every year you say that.
Well, this year I'm recovering from dental surgery, so there's no way I'm going to be seen in public for a while. But one of these years I will. It is, to me, it looks like the best event with the best people going, and I say that seriously. So just from networking alone... it's a gold mine, so I can't imagine not being there, but it's very frustrating that I'm not. But we will do it. Just have faith, as the scientists say.
All right.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate it very much.
All right. Thank you for having me on again. Always fun.
Always a pleasure. Listener, that's it for today. Thank you for your emails, for your phone calls and participation. Look on the newsletter, upcoming show events on the website. We got a full week planned, and we hope you participate. And everybody, goodbye from Chris Carberry, goodbye from myself and Mars and the Space Show. Everybody have a great week.